Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Elizabeth Ross from Duke University Department of Physical Therapy and Community and Family Medicine about motivational interviewing. What, when, how, and why? This is a really important topic that affects, I think, every adult, every listener, almost every physician as well, and just about every health condition. People want to change behaviors, and health behaviors lead healthier lives, and we'll talk with Dr. Ross about how to do it. Christy Page is on vacation this week, but we still have some really interesting research that matters that I'll be able to talk with about before we get into our interview with Dr. Ross. The research that we're going to cover today really looks at biases that doctors like myself and others could have subconsciously when they're diagnosing conditions. This was some research that just came out in the Journal of Pediatrics. We're going to be looking at hypertension and pre-hypertension in older adults and some really interesting research about exercises that may lower it. For any of our listeners or their family members who have hypo or hyperthyroid, the under or overactive thyroid, we're going to look at some research about that as well. So really interesting research. Let's jump right in there. The first research was in the Journal of Pediatrics, a study about abuse and children. And, you know, I think a lot of doctors have this belief that abuse perhaps only or happens more often in people of certain socioeconomic or lower income, but that is not true, really, in terms of we see it in all ages and in all ethnicities. But, you know, perhaps we do carry biases, maybe from where we trained, and we trained in places that we were in inner cities, like I trained some in Atlanta and Emory and in other cities. So we would see oftentimes very poor patients. And so that's where we perhaps saw the patients with abuse. We didn't train in areas that had much higher socioeconomic income patients. So this study looked at, well, maybe do doctors as a result of their training maybe have this type of bias? And what they did is they looked at surveyed 2,100 United States pediatricians and looked at four different cases about a hypothetical 18-month-old who had a leg fracture that maybe happened funny, that they didn't really know how it happened, which would be a red flag for many of us. But they then chained the child's race, whether the child was an 18-month-old who was black or white, and then also looked at whether the patient's families were an accountant, a bank manager, or perhaps they were in lower class jobs like working as a grocery clerk or a factory worker. And then they, you know, saw to what extent the pediatricians were likely to diagnose abuse. So what do you think the hypothesis is? Well, I can tell you mine, that they would be more likely to diagnose abuse perhaps in those with the working class jobs, and maybe even that they might subtly have a bias against the children who were black. What they found, and I think this is a good take-home point, is actually the pediatricians did not have any difference effect in terms of race on their responses. They had the same amount that they thought might be abuse with patients that were black versus patients that were white. And there was a difference, though, in low income, that almost half the pediatricians thought there had been abuse versus those with higher income patients and families. It was only 43%. Now, that's not a big difference, 7%, showing that I thought a good news here is that doctors are actually looking past race and looking past income when these cases are presenting more often. So this is, I think, good news. It also is a take-home reminder to myself and all of my colleagues and all of our listeners that abuse can happen at any age. It can happen to any person, any gender, any sex, ethnicity, and certainly any income. So more to come on that one. The second research really looks at this question of hypertension or pre-hypertension. Christy and I have talked about on the show many times that we really want to encourage listeners and patients to have lower blood pressure, much lower than when we were initially trained to think of it. So we would normally have said 140 over 90. And now we know really the lower the blood pressure, the more the brain is protected. And so we really would like it no higher than 120, the top number, the systolic number, or 80 in the bottom number. The question is, can exercise and what types of exercise can they really make a difference? And this was a really good research article in the American Journal of Cardiology that looked at swimming. And Christy and I have talked about swimming on the show numerous times. Matter of fact, I can hear Christy saying in my ear, you know, swimming is good. It's good for the joints. It's good for the emotional state. But what about blood pressure? And they looked at 43 adults, average age of 60, sounds like many of my patients and many of you, I'm sure, who had high blood pressure or pre-hypertension, but were otherwise pretty healthy. And they trained them to either have swimming, which case they 3 to 4 times a week, they worked their way up to swimming 45 minutes at a time, which is not totally unreasonable. You swim at your own pace. Or they went to learn relaxation exercises, which might be hypothesized to also lower blood pressure. And then they tracked at the end of the study what happened. Well, I was really pretty much blown away to see that those who actually did the swimming had a decrease of almost 10 points over the research study of their top number, their systolic blood pressure. It went from the study beginning of 128 down to 119, which is a significant drop, much greater than many of the dietary measures we try to encourage for high blood pressure. They also even looked at ultrasound tests to see how well the blood vessels were doing in response to these sorts of exercises, and they found that they relaxed more in those who were swimming, which is another great sign that the swimming actually was helping the blood pressure. In comparison, the relaxation exercises actually didn't change the blood pressure at all. I'm sure they were good. I'm sure they made people feel better, but it didn't change the blood pressure parameters. So, you know, swimming is really one of the top forms of exercise that people as they age really enjoy. And I think we should be encouraging more people to swim, more elders to swim. It's wonderful for the joints, and now we know it's even good for blood pressure. The last research that we're going to talk about with research that matters is the thyroid condition called hypothyroid, or the low thyroid, and hyperthyroid, or high thyroid. And I know that lots of people have these conditions, people in my own family and extended family, many of my patients, Dr. Page's patients. And, you know, we think often about diagnosing it and treating it when people have symptoms such as their heart rate running too low or feeling too cold all the time for hypothyroidism, or perhaps the heart rate running too high and feeling hot all the time and jittery with hyperthyroidism. And I think doctors and my colleagues do a good job of diagnosing this. But this study looked at, well, what happens with the common types of hypo and hyperthyroidism? How are these things related to people getting iodide, the type of things that you once sees in iodized salt? What happens when they get procedures, medical procedures that have iodine in them? And could this account for some of the cases of hypo and hyperthyroidism? Great question. This was in the Archives of Internal Medicine, and they looked at nearly 400 patients treated at Massachusetts General Hospital who had these hypo and hyperthyroidism, and they compared them to 1,400 patients who had normal thyroid function. And what they found is that there was a significantly greater likelihood of patients who had hypo or hyperthyroidism having had medical procedures in the past where they were exposed to radioactive iodide, which we know affects the thyroid. Very interesting research, perhaps not surprising, but it, I think, begins to pinpoint ways that we might be able to cut down on disease, not by saying that if you need a heart study or you need a particular study and they have to use this radioactive iodide, yes, you will have that. But perhaps asking your doctor when you're being told to have a procedure, am I going to be exposed to radioactive iodide? And are there some ways that I can avoid getting that exposure? This is an important question to ask, and I think this research helps us answer it. Well, that'll conclude what we can talk about on the research that matters. We've had a chance to really talk about that abuse happens in all age groups, and let's be more sensitive and aware that it can happen to anyone at any time, that high blood pressure actually can respond to swimming, great exercise for lots of reasons, and finally, that if you can avoid radioactive iodine, that is something that should be done. Well, that concludes Research That Matters. Take a short break, and when we return, I'll be talking with Dr. Elizabeth Ross about motivational interviewing, what, when, how, and why. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, I'm going to be having an interview with Dr. Elizabeth Ross about motivational interviewing, what, when, how, and why. And really so excited to have you on our show today, Dr. Ross. Dr. Elizabeth Ross is the Doctor of Physical Therapy and Assistant Consulting Professor at Duke University Medical Center, Community and Family Medicine. And she received her PhD, is it at Marymount?
Marymount
University, and a master's at Emory and University of Michigan undergraduate. And it's just wonderful to have you on the show today talking about something that's really important to, I think, every listener.
I think motivational interviewing is a very key skill to have for clinicians in working with patients.
Well, let me just start off and just say for our listeners, what is motivational interviewing and how did you get interested in this topic?
Well, motivational interviewing is really a communication technique for working with patients regarding behavior change. And basically, every patient we see, we're asking to make a behavioral change. It's either taking a medication or losing weight or stopping smoking. And so behavioral change is a part of almost every clinician's work.
And how'd you get interested in it?
I was introduced to it through an organization that I belong to that's the American Academy of Communication in Healthcare. And it is so intuitively wise that it just made perfect sense to me. And its application seems just so appropriate with almost any patient that you would have.
Well, you know, when we're in teaching medical students and when we ourselves went through medical school, we were taught to listen carefully and ask open-ended questions, and we could elicit patient stories and patient narratives. How does motivational interviewing differ from what we would normally be taught to do as just good medicine?
Well, I think it takes all those skills that you were taught, open-ended questions, active listening, reflecting patient statements, providing empathy, but that gets the patient's story. Then this takes it to the next level about trying to decide how you might have – whether a patient is ready to make a behavioral change. So you're kind of finding out where is the patient. You're assessing how motivated they are. And that way, motivational interviewing is kind of a misnomer because we're not cheerleading our patients into making a behavioral change. We're trying to find out where they are in preparation for a behavioral change. And if they are ready – then how can we provide the information that's going to help them make that change?
Well, I know that this is something that actually was not necessarily, I was not taught this as a resident or a medical student, and that it's really relatively new in the medical field, which actually is kind of exciting. I mean, we come up with, you know, and people hear about it. And in preparing for the show, I read a little bit that this was first maybe came about in thinking with problem drinkers or substance use. Have you encountered or seen, or how does that really work? Why would we want to use motivational interviewing with problem drinkers, for instance?
Well, it does have its roots in addictive behavior. And basically, we're trying to make the behavior change in our patients to behaviors that their habits that they have that may not be in the best interest of their health. So in terms of addressing those kinds of behaviors, it's done in a very non-judgmental way We're not trying.
Okay, what do you mean by non-judgmental?
I mean that, in other words, if a person is a smoker and you ask them about their smoking, it's in a non-judgmental way without saying, this is really bad for you.
If you don't quit, you're going to die.
If you don't quit, you're going to die.
That would not be motivational interviewing.
That would not be motivational interviewing. I think it's really, its roots are in the autonomy of the decision-making on the part of the patient and a deep respect for that patient's ability to make the change. I think it's also through the recognition that we can't make the change for our patients and that rarely do people make a really big behavioral change because someone told them to.
Well, if we're talking about motivational interviewing, and you mentioned problem drinking and substance use, nicotine, are we really talking about any type of health behavior, or are there motivational interviewing really only for a certain smaller subset of behaviors that people want to change?
I think it covers so many behaviors. As I say, starting an exercise program from the physical therapy perspective, it would be good for me to know up front how motivated my patient is to actually participate in that program before I issue the give them the exercises and send them off with them.
Okay, so let's say I'm a patient who doesn't exercise as much as they should. I won't disclose here to our listeners, but we could all use probably a little more exercise unless you're doing the triathlons. How would you begin that procedure with me as a patient to help me maybe think about this?
I would say to you, how do you feel about your exercise program or exercise that you're doing? And you could tell me, and I would say, how important do you think it is that you exercise? And that's one of the key things that it's part of motivational interviewing is using these rulers of importance and confidence. How important on a scale of 0, meaning not at all, to 10, meaning extremely important, do you think it is that you do an exercise program?
Well, I would think most people would say exercise really important. And I would even say most people might say that quitting smoking or, I mean, they people seem to know that this is a problem. So that part, I think, they would rate high on. Is that?
I think you're absolutely right. And that's why we don't need to give information. People know it's not good to smoke. They know it's not good to be overweight. They know it's not good to be sedentary. So then you do your confidence ruler. From 0 to 10, how confident are you that you could stay on an exercise program that you started today?
Well, it may not be the prettiest weather. It may perhaps be winter time.
Okay.
I may live in an unsafe area. I guess there could be lots of reasons why I might not necessarily. I'm working. I got children.
Right. Well, but I would say, just how confident are you if we found the right program for you that you could stay on the program? So it's more the confidence issue that you would continue to do it. And so that if that were, let's say, a 3, then I don't think it doesn't sound like you're real confident. So I would have that discussion with the patient. So it's a 3, but it's not a 0. So you have some confidence that you might be able to do a program. What would it take to go from a 3 to a 4? And then I'm trying to have the patient generate ideas for what might make it possible.
We're talking with Dr. Elizabeth Ross, Doctor of Physical Therapy, Duke University Medical Center, about motivational interviewing. And Dr. Ross, you've described some of the techniques, confidence, the belief in the problem. What about this area that motivational interviewing is not MD-led, but semi-directive? What does that mean? I've heard that described, that this isn't physician or clinician-led, but you're leading the conversation.
I'm asking the questions, and I'm actually trying to facilitate this conversation and to what we call develop the discrepancy for that patient so that they're going to think about, wow, I thought it was a 7. I thought it was pretty darn important, but I'm not really confident I could do that. And the trick is, because most clinicians want to seal the deal and push the patient over the edge to doing that behavior change.
So you're going
to
start exercising.
So I'm going to tell you all the bad things that are going to happen if you don't. And the idea is that you kind of can leave it there, let the patient think about that for a while, and then bring up the discussion in a non-threatening, non-judgmental way again, and that might lead to perhaps a movement in the numbers so that they are maybe ready to hear more about what that might look like for them.
Are there any health behaviors that are not suited to motivational interviewing that you say, well, it's really not to be used for gambling or other kind of bad behaviors? Or is this really something that's a tool that can be used to change any health behavior?
I think it could be used to change a health behavior. It's not obviously appropriate in an emergency situation that you're going to be measuring importance and confidence with somebody who needs an appendectomy. But it is something that any behavior change on the part of the patient could be amenable to using motivational interviewing.
Maybe someone who doesn't take their medications on a regular basis to help understand why?
Just asking that question, how important do you see this as being to your health? Would be a really insightful thing to know about that patient.
How confident can I take that antibiotic 4 times a day for 10 days?
Maybe not. So maybe we need to go for something that isn't as often if want to get success.
Yeah, great. Well, we need to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Elizabeth Ross, about motivational interviewing, what, when, how, and why. We'll be right back with Your Health.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And I've been talking with Dr. Elizabeth Ross, doctor of physical therapy and assistant consulting professor at Duke University Medical Center and the Community and Family Medicine, about motivational interviewing, what, when, how, and why. And I think, Dr. Ross, you've done a really nice job of letting our listeners know a little bit about kind of the what and the when, but and we've started to understand a little bit about the how, but what are the specific skills that a healthcare provider needs, or if you're a listener and a patient out there and you're really trying to assess whether or not your provider is good at this, what would you be looking for?
Well, some of the same skills we talked about that you teach medical students and physical therapy students about, just good communication, which is actively listening, really hearing what
your
patient...
How do you do that?
How do you do that?
You're doing a good job. I can assure all our listeners she's doing a great job right now. But how do you teach that? How's that done?
You really make people conscious of the fact that they are paying attention to somebody else when they're speaking. One of the activities I do with my students is I have them pick a contentious issue with another student. And they each have, the first person has the opportunity to speak and tell their side of the story or their opinion. The other person has to repeat back what the first person said to the satisfaction of the first person before the second person can give their remarks about their side of the issue.
So you have to listen really carefully in order to be able to reflect that.
Exactly.
Okay, what other skills do you need? Do you need active listening?
Active listening. Another thing I think is important is reflections. So when a patient says something, you reflect back to them what they said so that they actually get to hear it from another point of view. So
how does that work?
Sometimes a patient might say, well, you know, my mother is 80 years old and she never stopped smoking. And so you might reflect back, so it doesn't seem to you from your experience that smoking is that important to keeping you healthy.
Oh, so it's not just repeating what you just heard in active listening. It's actually you have to interpret it and then reflect back some meaning of that statement.
You can't. That is a rephrasing that I just did. You could just repeat back the words. So your mother is in good health and
so
she's never stopped
too.
Smoking. Yes. The idea is that they should hear that out loud and actually have a chance to reflect on that themselves and think, well, I don't know that I don't think it's important to my health, but I just know my mother has lived a long time without quitting smoking.
Okay, so we got two skills. I've heard we kind of you mentioned earlier about asking open-ended questions.
Yes.
Give me an example of open-ended question, how it might apply to motivational interview compared to perhaps the way many providers ask questions.
An open-ended statement. Tell me about your smoking. Patient will probably tell you how long they've been smoking, how much they smoke, whether they like it. I mean, they'll tell
versus
you a lot
saying
about
how much,
themselves.
Versus saying, how much do you smoke?
Exactly.
That yes-no sort of question.
And you'll get a feel for how they actually feel about it. Well, I know I should probably quit, but I just can't because all my friends smoke and my family smokes. You got a lot of information from that than if I had just asked, how much do you smoke every day?
And then I heard one last skill, and I'm curious because this seems to be maybe one of the more difficult ones, is to have some sort of summary statement that perhaps directs the conversation. That to me seems to be a much higher level function. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, summarizing, I think, is a very valuable skill in any communication. Partly, you're summarizing what the patient said, so you've validated that you've heard what the person has said, which is really effective. Plus, summarizing gives you a chance to think about where you might want to take the interview next. In terms of, you give the summary of what the situation was, so you've been smoking for 20 years, and you've thought about trying to stop smoking, but you've never really taken the steps to really do that. Do I have that right? And it kind of can lead you to your next question. So what have been your thoughts about quitting smoking? So again, a summary is a really nice way of showing a patient that you're listening, that you have the situation pretty clearly, because they'll make corrections if you didn't. And then it also helps you guide the interview to the next place.
Is there ever a fear that some patients think that this is therapy and that you're practicing therapy on them? How does motivational interviewing differ than what some people might think of as therapy?
Well, it's really actually can be extremely brief. It's not about, you can use empathy.
We don't have to be an hour in the psychiatrist's chair.
I have a video I show my students, and I purposely do it because it's 4.5 minutes long, and it's done. And basically, the gentleman that's interviewed is not agreeing to stop smoking. But because, and this, as I say, this is the hardest thing, is for the clinician to say, okay, it doesn't sound like you're really ready to change. And you kind of leave it. And he said, did I harass you? And the patient says, no, but you've given me something to think about. And that's the piece, that it can be.
That's when you know it worked. That's when you know it works, which actually is one of my next questions, which is, does it work? Because I guess we could be researching this, we could be teaching medical students this, we could be doing our radio show on this, but why are we having a conversation with Dr. Ross as an expert if it doesn't work? What do we know?
We do know that there is literature to support, research to support that this has made a difference, both medically as well as in substance abuse behavior.
Better than just saying, you better do it or you're going to die.
Right. But also, you've left the patient with a lot of self-respect and self-efficacy. And
a belief that they can change.
And they're the only ones that can make the change. I also like the way it takes the burden off of the clinician to be responsible for someone else's behavior. That you can maintain a good relationship with your patient by having the respect and for their autonomy as a person, and without having to feel the burden that I should have told them and that I'm responsible for whether they change. If they change, I'm a good doctor or I'm a good physical therapist, whereas it really resides in the patient.
We're talking with Dr. Elizabeth Ross about motivational interviewing. And Dr. Ross, I've heard this motivational interviewing described as non-judgmental, non-confrontational, non-adversarial, warmth, genuine empathy, and positive. Who wouldn't want that?
Can't imagine who'd want that.
Don't we want doctors like that and providers and clinicians and physical therapists?
Absolutely.
And I assume physical therapists can also do motivational interviewing. Absolutely.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. I think there is the temptation to think that you're supposed to cheerlead your patient into motivation. And the idea that the patient is going to be responsible for the behavior change is really a critical point.
Well, how do you teach this to learners? Because I know you are involved in teaching students at Duke and elsewhere. How do you teach it? And because these are skills. Skills take practice. You're talking about 4.5 minutes in a encounter that may only have 12 to 15 minutes. How do you do it?
Well, I do give the students the information, but the biggest part is the role plays. I set up situations where they are asked to use motivational interviewing with each other, and it's sort of getting used to using the words of motivational interviewing and really getting into the spirit, as they say, of how it is. To really be curious about how someone feels about a certain behavior and to be willing to support them in that change, but not be responsible for that change.
Well, we only have a minute or so left, but I want to ask you one final question, because I know you've actually done some research on this, which is when you teach and you have these students and probably providers practicing motivational interviewing, it's your research, I think, showed that it had some positive impact, much even broader on the motivational interviewing. These doctors practice more patient-centered care. Can you just tell us real briefly about that?
Well, it does take the focus to the patient, and it is more from the patient's perspective. And so it just is a natural inclination to work with the patient, to collaborate with the patient, rather than to be in a more directive kind of role and telling a patient what to do, authoritarian.
Well, this is a wonderful. We've been talking with Dr. Elizabeth Ross, doctor of physical therapy, lecturer at Duke University Medical Center, motivational interviewing. And I know we're going to do, actually for our listeners, we're going to go behind the scenes. We're actually going to do a role play or two. So feel free to listen to us behind the scenes and hear that. And I guess if you have one final parting comment about that would help patients a little bit in their quest to change their own behaviors they'd like to. What would you recommend?
Actually, for patients, I would recommend sort of actually thinking about assessing yourself. How important do I think a behavior change is? And how confident am I that I could do it? So that if I don't have confidence, then how would I gain more confidence? Do I want to ask for information from my physician or from my healthcare provider about how I could be helped to make a behavior change? And if I'm not ready, then maybe I'm not ready right now to make that change.
Well, thank you. That's a wonderful place to put a little bookmark in this conversation. We've been talking with Dr. Elizabeth Ross. Thank you so much for sharing your time and expertise with our listeners.
It was my pleasure.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For House Call segment of our show today, I'm going to spend a few minutes listening to your health questions and concerns. You certainly can send your own comments and questions about your concerns, and we'll play them on an upcoming show. Send them to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we've got some interesting questions today. The very first one is about someone who has a rash on their finger.
I'm 25 years old, and I had a rash on my finger. My doctor said it was a fungus, and I used an anti-fungus cream for 6 weeks with only a little improvement. I then went back, and he gave me a medicine called Lotrizone, which seems to have a fungus cream along with something like cortisone, and it got better much more quickly. But after I stopped it, a couple weeks later, the rash slowly came back. What do you think is going on here? Should I go back again to see the doctor?
Well, thank you so much for sending this question in. And our listeners know I love rashes. Christy loves rashes. We know that we can look at them and help make a diagnosis. And while this one, I don't have a picture here, I think this question is one that we hear not too infrequently, which is, you know, you come to see a doctor and you try a treatment and maybe it didn't work. And then you come back and you try another treatment, and it sounds like here it partially works. So the question is, do you come back a third time? Do you go see another doctor? Or what may be happening here? And I firmly believe that this is a good doctor who's giving you good treatments. But if you have to go back to a doctor three times for the same condition, sometimes you might want a second opinion too, because it may be that this particular provider may not be the best one for you for this condition. And the circumstance that you're talking about, you might have actually had eczema or inflammation of the skin of the finger rather than a fungus. And that would certainly explain why the inflammation did not respond just to the antifungal cream, but it did respond when you were given this medication called Lotrizone, which has a very potent anti-inflammatory medication, a very potent steroid, topical steroid with an antifungal. It's not the antifungal that was helping you with that combination. It's that potent anti-inflammatory. And the reality is also eczema is a chronic condition. And so you might have to take this medication on a more long-term basis, along with other things like a moisturizing cream, avoiding harsh soaps and chemicals on your hands, and maybe even a soap substitute. So, and there are cheaper, just generic, strong anti-inflammatory creams rather than a more expensive combination cream. So I would encourage you to perhaps stay with this physician or try another, maybe see a specialist, but certainly think about that maybe the diagnosis itself is what you need to get before you can get the right treatment. Thank you for your question. And let's hear our very next question that has to deal with getting a handicapped permit.
Dear Your Health, I simply want to know if it is okay for me to get a handicap permit. I enjoy walking, but I do have some arthritis in my knees, even if it is not hard most of the time. I am not crippled, but my doctor said it was okay thing to use. I do not want to be seen as someone who is abusing the system. Thanks.
Christy and I have heard this sort of question many times in our practices, and we certainly know that getting a handicap permit is not something really most of our patients take lightly. I don't think either one of us gets asked to give them for people who really don't need them. And certainly in your case, you do have arthritis of your knees, and you have had a conversation with your provider, and your provider actually feels comfortable about giving you a handicap permit. It sounds like the problem might be how you feel about having a handicapped permit. I know that when I see people parking in a handicapped spot and I see them get out of the car and walking normally, my first thought is sometimes, well, are they really handicapped? But I quickly check that thought and say, you know, I'm not the one to judge. There may be many reasons, including they have a heart condition, maybe they have cancer, maybe they're driving someone who is inside the store. There are many, many reasons. And I think that's the more important area. It's not what other people think, but it's really what you think and know. Your particular condition, I would encourage you to get the handicap permit. Perhaps in days you're feeling good, you won't use the handicap spot. And in days you don't, it's certainly reasonable. So good luck, and we hope that your knees actually feel better. Let's listen to our next question.
You see all those commercials on TV about being young and using testosterone. Well, I'm a 63-year-old, and I recently went to my doctor and got a prescription for this medicine. My doctor said he did not think it would hurt me, but he also did not think it would help. Well, he was right. After 3 months, I felt no different. What really helped my libido was talking about the whole issue with my doctor and starting a medicine that helped me with depression.
Well, commercials on the TV about feeling young and alive. Yes, I've seen those commercials. We've talked about it. Christy and I talk about these things. And we know that there are a lot of people going in and asking a lot of doctors and perhaps getting from a lot of pharmacies testosterone prescriptions. We also know that there's not a lot of research that the majority of people need these prescriptions, that they help really provide relief for things like changes in sexual function and desire. Nor is there great evidence there is some evidence also that they can be harmful in side effects. So I think Christy and I are certainly oftentimes ambivalent at best about providing these types of prescriptions. Sometimes we'll say maybe check a testosterone level in your bloodstream, and if it's low, perhaps try to see if one of these medicines could help. On the other hand, the great majority of people who have a lower testosterone may not benefit simply from this sort of medicine. It may be a natural function of their biological aging too. And if you have a normal testosterone, there's no evidence whatsoever really that these medicines will help you. So in your case, I'm not surprised that you didn't feel any different. And it sounds like getting into some therapy with the right provider, a provider who listened to you and prescribed an antidepressant, is what helped you more than anything. So thanks for sharing your story. It maybe goes counter to what the TV shows are showing, but it's important and real, and it's based more in what Christy and I probably experience. Thank you. Let's listen to our very next question about alcohol abuse.
What medicine is available to help people with problems drinking to stop? I appreciate your advice.
Oh, medicines to help people stop drinking. You know, that's such a good question because Christy and I have talked about the problems of alcohol abuse in society. I think internationally, 2 billion people consume alcohol every year, and yet 76 million do have alcohol-related problems. And the frequency of heavy drinking for those who have 5 drinks a day or more for men or 4 or more for women is really high. We also know that lots of people, even after they quit drinking, do relapse, particularly if they only have psychosocial or talk therapy alone. So the role of medications is an important one. And there is some bright hope here. It's not a golden egg. It's not a golden parachute, but it's something to start with, and we need more research. And that is, there is a medication called naltrexone or Revia, which actually can lead to almost a third reduction in the risk of a relapse if you've had problem drinking and you've quit. It can reduce the return to the drinking, the cravings and desires. It can increase the time that you might have to your first drink. And it seems to block the opioid receptors, those receptors that help give the alcohol's reinforcing effects to the brain. Certain people can't take that medicine, those who are on opiate or narcotic medications, those who have active liver disease, which some people with alcohol abuse certainly would have. But it seems to work really well with those who are genetically susceptible. So it's a good possibility and something that I think that we, if you have alcohol abuse problems, you should talk with your doctor about. There are other medicines, one called camprasate, also Camprel, a different mechanism, not quite as effective, less effect perhaps on heavy drinking, maybe better for those who are maintenance. And then finally, a medicine called disulfiram or Antabuse. It's been around for over 50 years. And if you drink alcohol while you're using the medicine, it causes you to get really sick, nausea, vomiting, sweating, because you accumulate toxic chemicals in the blood. But the research is really mixed if this provides any benefit. So it's not one that we prescribe frequently or lightly, particularly because it appears like maybe this naltrexone might be a better medicine. So if you have a loved one that you or you yourself have problems with alcohol use, feel free to ask your doctor, a primary care doctor, or someone who specializes in alcohol addictions about potential medications that can help you avoid a relapse. Well, that will conclude what we can talk about on House Calls today, and we thank you for your questions. If you have your own questions or concerns or comments, send them to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can go to yourhealthradio.org online or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and now iTunes. Free podcasts are available in the iTunes store. I'd like to thank the staff of WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Elizabeth Ross. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll look forward to having Christy rejoin us next week when we have another fascinating guest and topics. Thank you so much for listening.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.